Welcome to the RF Industry Icons podcast, where we will interview various well-known RF and microwave experts, entrepreneurs, and leaders in our industry. I'm Pat Hindle. I'm here with my co-host, Gary LaRoot. Today, we are talking with Dr. Ulrich Rode, well-known scientist, inventor of the first software-defined radio, entrepreneur, and one of the most decorated RF and microwave engineers in our industry. Welcome, Ulrich.
Thank you. Good morning.
You're a well-known pioneer in the RF and microwave industry with hundreds of publications, numerous patents, awards, and professorships, and too many to list here. What first got you interested in RF and microwave technology? Did that come from your father or from something else?
When you asked me the question, I had to think first. I was born in Germany into a really very scientific family. Both grandfathers were chemists, which made me decide not to go into chemistry. One was very famous. There's a Fischer-Tropsch method to generate gasoline, essentially, from coal. And my other grandfather had to do with organic chemistry. I really never asked him what exactly he did. And so my father went from chemistry to electrical engineering, and he took together with Schwarz. They started the Hilton Schwarz company. And to answer your question, my father took me into the office one day, and there were these US Army Jeeps, and they had shortwave radios in it, and they could really cover huge distances. So I was very curious, how does this work on a vehicle-based radio with a VIP antenna? And I had no concept how it worked, but it was impressive. So this got me really started. That's also including ham radio, which my father had. And in a sense, I've quoted this a few times, my father was dominant because he was so well known, it was hard to escape him. Wherever I went, are you the famous son of the more famous father? And I must say, I hated this and really wanted to get my own education. So later, after all the education, I went to the AEG telephone. They, at the time, had a nice leaflet about tubes. Very nice thing, I still have most of them. Siemens doesn't exist anymore, had a similar thing. And my father had a sailboat, and we invited many people for a nice sailing. And there was one day where I was with Heisenberg, and I must have been about 12 years old, something like this. And Heisenberg, who is well known for his uncertainty, see, I asked him, these tubes get very hot and you have a heater and you have a plate and you suck the electrons out. Why don't we take a radioactive isotope and have all the electrons you need? And then Heisenberg said, that's fine and dandy, but there's a grid on a tube which controls with a negative voltage the current. So how do you do this with an isotope? And I must admit, I missed this thing. So seeing how dumb I was at the time, I said, you really have to do something to learn a little bit more. And otherwise, the sailing was nice. The problem with sailing was that around lunchtime on the Starnberger Lake, Lake Starnberg, the wind died. So you had to be very careful what you're doing. One other episode, during my days at the university in Darmstadt, I published a book. 1965. It dealt with microwave transistors. The professors at the time was teaching about tubes. So I went one step further. I got really well hated doing this because I was one step ahead of this, and the professor gave me a huge hard time. And a girlfriend I had at the time, we bought a Smith Corona. It was the first electrical typewriter from America. It was an issue 110 to 20 volts. And the poor girl typed everything and then got rid of me because she shared it. I was really boring. And that's not the definition of a girlfriend and boyfriend to type books for somebody else. So this ended this episode.
Well, you've talked about your father, who was a technology pioneer and inventor, and the fact that he teamed with Hermann Schwarz to start Rodin Schwarz, which now is a multi-billion euro company with more than like 13,000 employees. I understand you expanded the company into the US and then later bought Compaq Software and now have launched Synergy Microwave, So clearly you have an entrepreneurial spirit, which seems, as we've talked about, to run in the family. Let's start with Compact. What led you to buy Compact Software and relaunch that company?
Yeah, that's a very specific question. At the time, I worked with RCA. I was in charge of all these radios. Our main customers was the National Security Agency. And we were building radios. And because of the shortwave radios at the time were pretty old-fashioned, we, as a team, invented the software-defined radio, which was highly secret. I remember flying to England and I had handcuffs with a suitcase and we had to destroy the paperwork after this conference. But then RCA, being quite successful, General Electric took it off the market. They bought all the shares, they destroyed everything. David Sarnoff Laboratory became his own status, then the Hertz Dental Company was there, but they actually made money in splitting this whole thing. And so I was there in a capacity which I already had in Germany. In Germany, I worked for AEG Telefunken. I was also in charge of all these electronic counter-espionage things. And my job at the time was build and design a counter radio to the PRC-104 from US aircraft. So in my opinion, we did this much better. The main problem with US aircraft was they used integrated circuits, which nobody else could get, so we couldn't repair it. So when RCA then was taken off the market, so to speak, around these times, I had a software company in parallel, which was Communication Consulting Corporation. And in this capacity, I did some things, and the National Security Agency asked me to design a radio. Remember, this was 1982. A code name Songfest for all the embassies so they could listen. And so I had a job immediately after RCA being dissolved. And I went to Engelmann Microwave, which is a New Jersey-based company. We built, I think, 5 or 6 prototypes that worked. And then a suspicious fire killed everything. And we were sitting there with employees, no job. Everything fell apart. So I felt I had to do something. So we took the knowledge we gained from this and the employees and founded Synergy Microwave. That's the reason to make something useful out of an actually bad situation. And it was very bitter. I remember the staying there and it was awful. And the other thing is of interest at my time at AEG Telefunken Germany, I wasn't high enough in the ranks. So they wouldn't fly, allow me to fly to Germany. So we really were behind what America was doing. Today, this is much better. And I was quite happy when the people who ran the Rudolf Schwarz organization in America had to retire age. So I inherited the job running RNS subsidiary in America by accident, not by choice. And I got stuck here. Actually, I like it quite well. And given the current situation, I think I'm much better from America than Germany, but that's a political side issue. And in addition to this communication consulting corporation, we had a CAD tool, which friends of mine generated. Product name was CADEC, C-A-D-E-C, not very inventional. A computer-aided design of electrical circuits. It ran on the Hewlett-Packard computer, I think HP200, whatever the series were. This was quite powerful, but no match with the Compact software linear program. And so we saw quite a large number of these, basically because we were affordable. And then when I was able to buy Compact software with several bidders, and we negotiated a purchase agreement, which was quite complicated because if you buy a company like this, you enter obligations. There were people who prepaid software updates. And I had to form a team And then within 1 year, supply updates, which I had no idea at the time how to do this. It was really a struggle. And I remember many days when I was driving home, wasn't sure whether I closed the door to the building or not. It was extraordinary difficulty. But the Les Besser program was a linear cable-based program only. And our job was to generate the harmonic balance and spice type to the linear program. It was a huge effort. And we were the first to solve the time domain nonlinear mathematics. So yes, we built up this company from a bunch of trucks with dead bugs, chairs, tapes, and you should have seen this was awful. I got two containers and nothing useful. And it was a really 10 years of my life, extraordinary hard work. But the problem I had, I didn't go fast enough, and Hewlett Packard always won. The engineers would tell me, well, if I buy from you, it doesn't work. It's my fault. If I buy from Hewlett Packard, it's their fault. But nobody can do it better. And we didn't do any mathematical shortcuts, so we were slower than Hewlett Packard at the time, the ADS program. And I told everybody in the repeat that, yeah, yes, it's Hewlett Packard. You get faster to the wrong answer. I had to do with a mathematical shortcut. I can't talk about what these things do today, but these were very trying times in my life, and many nights I didn't know what I was coming or going. It was almost financially a hazard. As 10 men in the beginning working against Hewlett Packard, that's, I don't wish anybody to try this. That's quite an effort.
So you spent that decade improving the compact software. What led you to sell it to Ansoft, which became part of Ansys now?
Well, the selling had to do really two necessities. The Ansoft had a huge number of sales offices. So part of their success had to do with extraordinary good distribution. And they had a 3D simulator. But as most people know, the key in the world is SPICE, in the sense that the largest number of electrical circuits ever done were SPICE. And SPICE is a pure time domain program, and the computation speed of SPICE is linear proportional to the size. So if you go from 1 picofarad to 1 farad, it's e to the power of 12 lower. And the harmonic balance program, which we implemented, splits the nonlinear tile way in picoseconds, and the linear, which is computation time, is irrelevant to the size number. The first and most useful frame to put this in was done by Professor Rizzoli in Italy, Pucell, who I worked with during the MIMIC TI joint venture. He connected the two of us, so we took a mathematically very good framework and added all kinds of capabilities. And this program, in my opinion, still today is the most accurate one. Everybody tries to mimic it. But then there was the thing of what they did, 3D simulation. And I understand you already interviewed Raudio. One of Raudio's main success was that he could simulate curved structures. In the past, one used triangular systems to kind of make these triangles small enough. You can do a bend or some curve. And this is mathematically the meshing. The meshing generator is the real need in any of these mathematical tools. And I just couldn't find anybody here on the East Coast who could help me. And so that was a perfect match. They had the HFSS, in my opinion, still the best, but they had no circuit simulator. At the circuit simulator, in doing so, we did a merger. What does this mean? I didn't sell the company, I took shares from them. And so I got 1.5 million shares from Ansoft, and Ansoft at the tail, at the end of the day, 10, 15 years later, I sold for $1 billion to Ansys. And that was a major stockholders. So the money I have today and spend is not inheritance from my father or Roland Schwarz. It's something I really earned myself, and I'm proud of this. I think it's a bad thing if your definition, you're an heir to some fortune. I think you're better off if you earn it yourself. So the necessity was lack of some technology which I just couldn't get, and a better distribution was a perfect situation.
Well, that sounds like it was a great business decision. I started out my career at Raytheon, right down the hall from Robert Pucelle, making chips, you know, using the technology you developed to simulate them. I was helping to manufacture them. So very interesting.
Yeah, there's one key publication, I think the most important one in my life, which Pucelle, then Parview and I in 1988 in your magazine, of all places, in your very magazine, was the first public demonstration that the nonlinear noise problem, which we had invented, does work. So we took a microwave chip, very complicated, less than 2 dB noise figure, if you could back my name, in 1988, and had the pleasure of having Pucelle on the cover. We did it. We proved that we solved the, which nobody else could do in the world, this nonlinear noise out of the SPICE model. We didn't have any measured data, but the accuracy of the mathematics, which actually I did this from the SPICE parameter of the FET, gave the correct gain and noise answer. I was very proud of it. I'm not sure anybody understood this, but this was the most important thing for nonlinear noise ever in the world.
Very impressive. Well, we've talked earlier a little bit about military radios and software-defined radios. Tell us more about the path from your early experience in military radios to the development of the software-defined radio.
Now, as I mentioned, after university and being fired from 2 jobs because of takeovers in Germany, was not a pleasant situation. Ended up in AAG Telefunken, and I was in charge of all the military activities. The problem was that after the war, the law was they couldn't do any military things in Berlin. The headquarters of AG Telefunken was in Berlin. So I was in Ulm, where the law didn't apply. So I was in charge of submarine transmitters and Manpex. A bunch of us were stuck in a snowstorm in Madesimo in Italy, and we had peanuts, a candle, and nothing else to do. And so we came up with a block diagram of a Manpex in competition to the PSC-104. This really outperformed the PSC-104. And some years ago, by mistake, I typed to a surplus dealer and bought 30 of those radios. I split 15 in Germany and 15 here in America. And this was incredible radio because it was the first that had automatic antenna tuner, RF speech processing, ultra-linear output of the synthesizer, and a lot of special features. Vogart amplifier, which means regardless how you hold your microphone, it would automatically adjust so that modulation is constant. And the key thing, in my opinion, what we invented was a pin diode attenuator from the antenna. Because the environment is RF-wise very noisy, the pin diode attenuator then automatically reduces the input signals. It's not necessary for 10 dB, 15 dB attenuation up front. And this, for a normal radio, increases the intercept point. A mixer follows the 3 dB per dB rule, which means if you decrease by 1 dB the gain, the intermodulation distortion products go back down by 3 dB or the opposite. And which lets me now to RCA. In RCA, we had the problem to really make receiver, which are much better. And in filter theory, there's something called a Gibbs phenomenon. Gibbs phenomenon is a ringing effect. If you have a signal adjacent to your filter and the signal bounces off the filter, it starts ringing like a bell in a church. And so depending how you mathematically do this, the ringing is louder. After Collins radios, the Collins radios had fairly cheap in the sense of frequency response filters. And we invented at RCA the composite filter, which means the first 6 to 10 dB were Gauss filter or equal ripple. And then we went to elliptical filter, which really did a huge separation. But modern consequence on these is useless. The transmitters are very noisy, so it makes no sense to build a receiver infinitely good. So anyhow, at RCA, then we, being responsible for all these radios, we decided to look into a more modern thing. First thing was to replace the mechanical filter, which are costly and transduce the distortion. So we invented the software-defined radio from the back. So the first thing we did is we did an audio filter to shape the noise, and then the IF, we made the IF better than any mechanical or crystal filter could do. The crystal filter has also intermodulation, so does the transducer have. So we worked ourselves up to the beginning. And then at the end, we had a software-defined radio, which at the time was not by far not as good as today, but the principle was born. And this was the success we had. It cost less money. Once you align the mathematics, there's no alignment. You just put in the code and it's stable and was fun. I mean, after I left RCA, in the journal Ham Radio, which unfortunately doesn't exist anymore, I put a write up and I put the names of those people who worked with me. I don't want to claim that I invented everything. It's always a team effort since we've done. I was lucky to be the team leader, but there were many people who helped, and it's important not to claim things you haven't invented. But it's in this, and this friend of mine who ran Ham Radio, he had skin cancer. And he got so excited about this, he died from a heart attack, not from the skin cancer. It's what a shame. But there's a write-up for this. I forgot the year, but I think it's 1985, something like this, when I left RCA and I got permission to publish this. So it's well documented that we as a team invented the really workable software-defined radio. And this goes back, so I've been on all these things from the left.
So you have a very deep understanding of the physics and science for high frequency oscillators. What motivated you to delve deeply into that area of expertise?
The reason that triggered this was when I was living in Germany on the, I forgot, 19th floor. I had a huge antenna up there. I couldn't hear anything. And the reason for this was the phase noise of the radio. And so initially, when the first tube radios were made, the crystals have essentially no noise. I mean, they're extremely good. And the free running oscillators at 3, 4, 5 megahertz had high Q resonators and no reactor diodes. Everything was clean. So these were very good. The very moment you build a synthesizer with a high IF, modern radios have an IF, which is 1.5 times the higher frequency. So if you have a 30 megahertz frequency at top reception, you need 45 megahertz as the second IF. I'm sorry, it's the first IF. And then you need a synthesizer to mix this up to 45 megahertz. So then you have 40 to 70 megahertz synthesizer. And by the time you build this, these synthesizers with all their loops are very noisy. And the adjacent channel interference, ACPR is now word blocking, there are many words to express the same thing, prevent you together with mixer intermodulation distortion at good reception. So a better synthesizer and oscillator phase noise became a necessity simply to maintain good reception in a crowded environment. So these are two things. Engelmann also was there. Mixer is an extraordinarily important thing in the synthesizer and no noise. If you don't have no noise, you don't survive it. And what we do at Synergy is really the best. And if you do for radar, for instance, you mentioned that you worked with radium, the less noise you have, the further away you can look at your target. So if somebody sends you a missile and you have 10 or 15 dB less noise, you can look further out. So there's a reason why to make the phase noise as bad as possible. And the zero crossing is called phase jitter is an important thing here.
So Synergy Microwave is very well known for your low phase noise oscillators. And yet I think I heard you say that Synergy really came out of the end of your career at RCA and the losing a project at your consulting firm. So tell us that story again. what led to the formation of Synergy?
So I forgot, I think it was DARPA. DARPA, I won a contract for a shortwave radio. And the key things in the receiver is the quality of the mixer and the synthesizer, low-noise synthesizer. And so when then the suspicious fryer killed these Engelmann microwave building, I mean, they had no sprinkler system. They had to come with a bulldozer and flatten the whole thing. It was awful. And I had from my father on loan $50,000-$60,000 worth of test equipment, and everything was gone. And I had a hard time calling my father and saying, your money's gone. This was unpleasant. But anyhow, so we had the expertise to build a better mixer and better signal generators with VCOs. And these were the basic things that we took because I owned it. And we built Synergy microwave out of it from these components. We were initially in Jersey City in a, I don't want to describe the building anymore, it was low cost building. And then we drove by it in Paris and Bondi and found this building, which came from a bankruptcy, huge building and empty. They made plastic bags and they looked awful. And then out of the bankruptcy, we bought the thing and put Synergy microwave in there. And it has been extraordinarily successful. And together with the 5G and 6G, we built a lot of ultra low noise synthesizer modules as the trigger generator. If you have these DDS synthesizer or signal generators, you need a reference signal in which you clock generation of these. And there we are the best because we just have the best mathematics. But it works very well. And the reason was necessity, was an issue number one, to make sure these people don't lose their job and we don't forget all their knowledge. So the combination of this made Synergy a successful company.
So you've been very involved in academia throughout your career. You've supported a lot of research. You've taught at several universities and been awarded many professorships. What has kept you so active in the area of academia?
Academia is interesting because at the time, most of the research was done in academia, less in companies has changed. Nowadays, companies fund academia to develop certain things, which is not always good because they specialize. But if you are involved in these academic things, you meet a lot of people, you see what they work on, you can educate them, you interface with them, you can see what their needs are. And if you have your finger in what's going on, it's extremely useful to get information both to the students and back from the students to you. And each university has different things. I've always argued with the ranking system of university because I don't believe, like, same thing with a bank. There is no bad bank or good bank. There's no good or bad university. The professor at the end of the day forms what the university does. And if it's a good professor, he does a good thing. If it's a lousy professor, and the university hires the professor. So the way it goes is the university selects a particular professor and then they're stuck with him. In Germany, a civil servant. And in Brandenburg, which is an area close to Berlin, I gave the university a lot of money. I gave them an endowment, not one of those 6 months or 9 months, but of a full lifetime. I gave the university a lifetime endowment of a professor, which I think is excellent. And this area of Germany is like a labor surplus. They just didn't have the money. Some of the states in Germany have infinite money or much more money. In Bavaria, for instance, has a lot of money, but the Brandenburg, this Berlin area, is not so fortunate. So I gave them the lifetime money to do this. And why could I afford this? Not because I have a rich father, but I earned the money from selling the merger than this Compaq software. So it's my money and not family money. And the guy's very good. So that's how it fits together. It's a feedback system. And this year, two of my books had a second revision. And one funny story. I remember at Drexel University, I was on the PhD committee and asked the questions, and I said, giving three choices, why did you use this one and not this one? Then I was removed from the PhD committee. They threw me out. And 10 years later, the candidate said, my apologies. Sorry, the question was legitimate. I don't know why Drexel University didn't allow questions of us. Sometimes being honest is not so good, and I've said a few times in my life, I'd rather be honest and ask the right question. The candidate needs to know why it does this. And sometimes the professor steals you. But the combination of industry and academia is really the best of both worlds. You look in both directions, you see what's needed. In mathematics, you learn a lot, so you really stay alive. If you're only a manager, then you lose of insight in some of the modern technique. And if you do both, you run for your life. If you could see my place here backwards, I have two computers side by side, and I'm just rewriting this book from 1965, reading it all the latest. And I look at terahertz of things. So I'm quite busy, and I like this. I'm a hybrid between industrialist, so to speak, and a scientist. Probably not very good at both, but the combination looks good.
We recently interviewed Les Besser, who expressed concern about the declining interest in science and technology among young people in the U.S. Do you share the same concerns?
He's absolutely correct, isn't he? There's no question. I mean, first of all, Les Besser has educated a huge number of engineers, which I think his institution should be accredited like a university. Second, the fences that drive people not to go to some colleges is unfortunate. I'm an accredited university professor in Germany, so I have done and helped people for essentially $2,000 to get a PhD and work with them. The American system is just too expensive, it can't be afforded. And which goes back to what I said before, the quality of the university professors is determined by the university. So the rank, in a sense, the ranking of the university is done by itself, but if the professor is useless, you can't do much. But Les Besser and I go back many years. I bought his company, which was abandoned by all his employees. But his statement is right on. I mean, nobody wants to do these things. And if you look at the faces of the students, they are mostly Chinese, Japanese, or something like this. And I don't know who pays their $500,000 for a board. But they legally export the knowledge, which then America complains as intellectual theft. I mean, I don't understand this. You educate these people, they work on industry programs, they have access to every and all the things America is trying not to export. So these things legally leave America, and then we make a lot of noise and say the Chinese are stealing everything. I don't understand this. But,
So you've received a large number of awards and honors. Way too many for us to mention here. The most recent, though, was the Cross of Merit of the Federal Republic of Germany, which is awarded by the President of Germany and recommended by the President of the State of Bavaria, which is one of Germany's top honors. Is there one award that stands out among others, or is that hard to say?
Well, first of all, I'm an American citizen, born in Germany, in Munich, so that the Bavarian president recommended me makes some sense. I am a member of the ex-Royal Academy of Science in Munich. So I'm involved in all these things and work with them. And I don't know the exact sequence, but yes, the German Cross is the highest award the country can give you. It comes in different flavors. So there's one with a shoulder band, which the Queen of England gets, a normal individual, I would never get this. So there's a political scaling in it. But given my position, it's the highest I can get. I was totally surprised. No idea. Within the other things, it depends who you ask what's the highest award. I got many, and I've been teaching at so many universities. And then every year they ask who should be given an award. And this is triggered then by people who sponsor you, and then it goes. It's an international voting. It's not something which happens in America, but it's international. And I could also tell you many awards I didn't get. So while you see the things I got, the IEEE know that they have 100 times more awards. So maybe I've accumulated things and I honestly don't know which one is the best. It's subjective. I like the one which I got for the software-defined radio, obviously, because I like it. We talked about synthesizer a lot. I have the three and all three of the Frequency Control Society. It's unusual, we have all three of them. These are the outstanding, but doesn't mean that the antenna and propagation society is worth less, because ham radio, I do a lot of with antenna. I don't think that's a straightforward answer. It's a legitimate question, but I can't really answer it.
As you look back on the various technologies and products that you've developed over your career, what would you say has been the most interesting to work on? And then separately, which one would you say has the most potential to change industry and society?
Well, you go back to my favorite synthesizer book. I mean, I just had the second edition of my synthesizer book, so everything has to do with oscillator. Was the most interesting, also mathematically most challenging. And as you go higher in frequency, I think the technology today is really driven by the foundries, silicon foundries, gallium arsenide. Contrary to what many people say, we at Roland Schwarz used to use some gallium arsenide and we had difficulties with how long they would work. 3 or 4 years, then they died. So nobody knows why. So the reliability issue for gallium arsenide, I'm not so happy with. Gallium nitride has about 10 times the breakdown voltage and much better thermal conductivity. There are no discussions with aluminum nitride. I'm not an expert on this, but I think the semiconductor industry has the most impact on this. My university professor assignment is for circuit theory, not for semiconductor physics. So I'm not good enough to answer this question. I'm a user, but not a designer. And A.G. Potter, who's my chief scientist, and I, we've done some crazy things in the area of metamaterial, which has a huge potential. The metamaterial is something which doesn't exist in nature. It's an artificial resonance block, which kind of takes energy from the surrounding. And in radio amateur terms, we call it a Q multiplier. It used some trick which made the electrical Q higher than it would normally be. And by this, you can make the signal noise ratio improvement. There are graphene, all kinds of things going on. I believe that the future strength is really in the semiconductor house integration. And one thing I'd like to do is strongly disagree with this Moore symptom because there's a physics limit. One is you cannot do enough current if the gold layer, which is put on top of the surface, if it's too thin, it evaporates. So there is a physics thing which doesn't work. And the breakdown voltage, band gap model, I mean, if you go definitely below 1 volt and you have the RF voltage ring, it kills you. So this system is not considering some of the violation of laws of physics. So there's a finite time. Also, the transistor, which has one electron moving, is kind of useless. So there are certain things. Unless we invent vacuum tubes first, then the transistors, as we know them, first germanium, then silicon, and silicon germanium, and then gallium arsenide, and I don't know where this ends. I'm currently working with sort of HEMS transistors, which go up to 26 gigahertz. I can't tell you how thin you can make these layers because the photolithography is expensive. I think part of the development cost is $7 million per one shot, and the first one doesn't do it. And our company, Roland Schwarz in Germany, we have a handful of integrated circuits which we build ourselves. We went to a German company and had these done, so we are politically correct, don't have any import problems. We have about 20 or so oscillator strips, I think, which are built in Germany. So come hell and high water, we have those key elements. And the competitors, analog device, they do something better, but analog device, in for some ICs with a slightly less performance, cost $90, an ounce cost $15. The thing which is very important is the breakdown voltage. And most of the high volume industry things like National Instruments or TI also make is a heat problem. And because we use these things in environment where we have lots of fans and cooling, we can afford a slightly higher operation. And so the signal to noise ratio is better in the things we do because we cool it better. The analog device, if they would apply the same thing, would be equal, but it's more a high volume, low cost thing, so while we need high performance. We build testers for 5G and 6G, and you have to have a test system which is better than the best radio you can build. So what comes first? To build some, you have to measure it, and so we are always on the run.
Well, thank you, Ulrich, for recounting your life's work and the impact you've had on our industry. I think one of the lessons listening to you from your story is your career path was not linear and certainly not without significant challenges that you had to overcome. So you have a very fascinating story, and we appreciate you sharing it with us.
Yeah, and I'd like to mention I got fired a few times from a job, and the story I would like to end with. I worked for a company that made walkie-talkies for taxis, and I made the effort and took the folder home because I felt the thing didn't really work well. And so I found a solution when I came back on Monday and said, here's a solution. I got fired because the guy said he never in his life did have anybody who volunteered to work all the weekend, and the only thing he can think of was a spy. And this was the termination of my employment from where I went to AEG Telefunken. And in AEG Telefunken had a similar effect. We built police radios, which had I don't know how many crystals. And I said, that's too expensive. So I invented a synthesizer in there, probably one of the first one. The police frequency, 150 megahertz, was so close to the radio amateur frequency band of 144. I said, why don't we build a ham radio equipment, which is only percentage-wise very close, and the ham radio societies are mostly undisciplined. They go on any frequency, don't even ask the frequency occupied. There's nothing more than the sound stop. I built this. And then one of my co-workers went to top management and accused me of building at the company cost something which is totally private and not unheard of. Then I went to the guy and said, yes, you're correct. I've done something. Why did I do it? It's 10% off, so the physics is the same. If I make these tests on the police frequency, I go to jail. I don't have enough signal generators to do all the things. I had no choice but to validate the circuit. And I had to do this in the most hostile of all equipment, of all environment. And the ham radio society with all their comes and goes was the most hostile. And so I had a solid verification that the synthesizer approach, which reduced the cost by about 90%, it was 10% risk. I validated it works. I had no other choice to do this. And if you want to send me home, so be it, but I solved your puzzle. And which time I got promoted and became in charge of all the military equipment. But this was a funny feeling. You get to ask, why do you build at our expense ham radio equipment? This was a funny discussion. I'll never forget this. But at least the solution was worth. I probably built in Germany the first synthesizer for police radio, money saving.
That reminds me of the Jerry Garcia line, what a long, strange trip it's been. And with that, we wrap up this episode of RF Industry Icons. For our listeners, thank you for listening today, and join us for our next episode of RF Industry Icons.